This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, from podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to the Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I'm joined today by Professor Mick Roberts, who is Professor of Mathematical Biology at Massey in Auckland. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you've been in Dunedin to give a talk for the Royal Society called Epidemics and Pandemics, a Numbers Game. Tell me first about your involvement in the Royal Society. You're a fellow, I believe.
I am a fellow of the Royal Society. I was elected a couple of years ago now, and it's always a great honour and a surprise when you get made a fellow of the Royal Society. And the Royal Society exists as a professional body for scientists and to communicate with the wider public about science in many different ways. And this year is the year of mathematics of planet Earth. And in view of that, the Royal Society is promoting a series of called 10 by 10 lectures, where each month, for 10 months, they have a lecture in a different part of New Zealand, given by someone they describe as an eminent person or an expert in the field.
That must be you.
Obviously, yes. And so the other thing they've made as a, I suppose, a condition is that you don't give the lecture in your own place. So I live in Auckland and I'm in Dunedin to give a lecture.
And you're not giving this talk lots. This is a one-off talk.
This is a one-off,
right? And it's a reflection on some of the work you're doing. You describe yourself. I saw somewhere you described yourself as a mathematical biologist, or words to that effect. And somewhere else, I saw yourself described as a mathematical epidemiologist.
Well, the mathematical epidemiologist is a bit more specialised. Epidemiology is the study of diseases, and in particular, I work on the study of infectious diseases and how infectious diseases spread through populations. I'm a mathematician, so I'm a professor of mathematical biology at Massey University. My first degree was actually in aeronautical engineering, so I've come to mathematical biology by a devious route, if you like.
So how did you get from aeronautical engineering to maths and then to biology?
Okay. Well, I graduated from Bristol University in aeronautical engineering and worked for what was at the time the British Aircraft Corporation, now British Aerospace, or BAE Systems, I think now they're called, in the UK. And I decided that really engineering wasn't for me and I would rather do mathematics. So I then did an MSc, a master's degree, at what was Cranfield Institute of Technology, which is now Cranfield University. And that was a little ironic because Cranfield was set up to train people for the aircraft industry in the first place. And I went there and did an MSc in applied mathematics to get out of the aircraft industry. However, following that, I came to New Zealand and did a PhD in mathematics at Victoria University in Wellington. And this was a PhD, in applied mathematics, and specifically in fluid mechanics. And following the PhD, I was looking for a job. And first of all, I went to work for the Ministry of Works in Wellington, essentially as a computer programmer or developing computer systems, because it was all that was available at the time. And at that time, there was a document called the Public Service Circular. And the Public Service Circular advertised jobs in the public service. It came out every Friday, and I was browsing through that, and I saw that the Wallaceville Animal Research Centre, which was in Upper Hutt, wanted somebody to model biological systems mathematically. And I thought, well, I could do that. And it's probably more interesting than being a computer programmer at the Ministry of Works. So I applied and I got the job. So, having not done any biology since I left school, I joined the Wallaceville Animal Research Centre as a mathematician and started modelling infectious diseases.
I was going to ask you about the nature of applied and pure maths and what is the role of maths, but it seems very much you're firmly in the applied maths space.
I have taught some pure maths courses since I've been at Mathsy.
Mm-hmm.
Applied mathematics is really just mathematics applied to some modelling situation. And pure mathematics develops mathematical techniques without having their application in mind. But many of the techniques that are developed by pure mathematicians are quite applicable to modern day situations. And so you end up with applied mathematics. And one of the jobs of applied mathematicians is to take up the new results that come out of pure mathematics and see if they can be applied and improve our understanding of the world.
When you're talking to incoming students, how do you describe what is the, I was going to say the science, the art perhaps, of maths?
Science.
Okay.
Well, I suppose it's a science and an art, but we're very much rooted in science at Massey University. And you explain to them, really, sounds trite to say the joy of mathematics or something like that, but it's fascinatingly interesting how a technique can be applied to seemingly totally unconnected situations, but the same mathematical techniques can be applied in a whole variety of different areas, including biology and engineering and fluid mechanics and finance these days, social systems. The same type of mathematics gets applied all over the place. And that keeps mathematics very interesting, fascinating.
Because one day you're applying something to viruses and the next day the same model, you might find yourself applying the same model or a different one to something entirely different.
Yeah, or the model that you apply to viruses you might have found in a textbook on financial mathematics. Or you can see how the same models can be applied to my sort of situation, the spread of infectious diseases. They can be applied to very similar models get applied in mathematical neuroscience, how neurons are firing in your brain. You can apply them to how weeds spread in the countryside, network models that are used for the spread of infectious diseases are being used for the spread of financial collapses in the banking industry. They're being used for spread of social ideas, rumours, voter behaviour. It's almost infinite, the number of applications there are for mathematics, and you find that the same techniques are being used in all different situations.
I want to come back to talking about the I've forgotten what it stands for, the MP, the Planet Earth, Mathematics of Planet Earth. But we'll come back to that after we've talked a bit about your work and the work that you're doing. So let's ask the easy question. Tell me about that.
Tell me about my work.
Okay. That was cheating as an interviewer. I shouldn't do that. So, okay, I'll do it anyway. Infectious diseases. This is of people. You're primarily involved in people?
Primarily of people at the moment. When I went to the Wellesville Animal Research Centre all those years ago, they're obviously interested in diseases of animals. Again, the same techniques apply. In fact, some of the viruses are very similar, are related to each other. And early on, I was coming down to Dunedin quite regularly because I was working on a parasite that caused hydatid disease that was a problem in New Zealand at the time. And this is a parasite of sheep and dogs. And there was a hydatid research unit situated in the medical school at Otago University. And I used to come down and visit them. And we published a series of models on the dynamics of hydatid disease in sheep and dogs. And we used that to inform the hydatid control policy that was in place at the time. And so that was one of my first applications of mathematics in biology. Now, hydatids has now been eradicated in New Zealand. It's still a problem in some parts of the world. So then you move on. And while at Wallaceville, I worked on projects such as other parasites of sheep, nematode parasites. I worked on tuberculosis in possums. And then I was contacted almost out of the blue by the Ministry of Health, who asked me to work on the measles vaccination program. And that was probably was a very successful project. This was way back in 1996, and there hadn't been an epidemic of measles since 1991 in New Zealand. And some people believe that there never would be another epidemic of measles. And others pointed out that, the one before 1991 had been 1985, and that was 6 years. And you add 6 years to 1991, you get 1997. So although the vaccination strategy had been improved on over the years, they wanted to know, are we due for another epidemic of measles next year in New Zealand? And I made a mathematical model of the dynamics of measles in New Zealand. And there were a lot of unknowns, so you were guessing at parameters. But I came up with the result that, yes, there could well be an epidemic of measles in New Zealand in 1997. And on that basis, the ministry started a mass vaccination campaign. I was, in 1997, actually giving a talk about this at a meeting on the Isle of Skye in Scotland, and pointed out that, I didn't hope I was right, but it was pointed out in the audience that how would anyone know if I was right? Because if they went out and vaccinated everybody and there wasn't an epidemic of measles, then some people could claim that there never was going to be one anyway. And other people would claim that it was a really good thing because they vaccinated and stopped it.
So are these models, if you go out and working, say you to go out and be asked to work on measles now, do you start by looking at the sort of historical trends of it coming up every 7 years?
Well, it had been every 2 years up to the start of the vaccination campaign. But when the MMR vaccine was introduced, up to then there had been an epidemic of measles every 2 years. And then after they started rolling out the vaccination campaign, they were vaccinating children at 15 months. Then the gap between epidemics started to get wider. And then they introduced a second MMR vaccination at 11 years. And the gap was getting wider and wider to 5 years, six years.
But presumably your model is more elaborate than, well, it wasn't the measles epidemic last year, it must be this year, or however that's spread out. Is it? It's more of a functional model about how the disease is spreading.
Model about you've got so many susceptible people in the population, and you've got a number infectious, and you've got a number that are immune because they've either had measles or they've been vaccinated. And between epidemics, if you're not vaccinating enough people, then the number of susceptibles you've got in the population is increasing. And that is a key point, because it's like a fire, it needs enough fuel. So after you've had an epidemic, you've used up your fuel, and there are still some susceptible people in the population, but not enough to maintain an epidemic. The epidemic dies out. You know, that's because people who are infectious aren't meeting enough other people who are susceptible. People, they're meeting more people who've either had measles or been vaccinated against measles. And then, if you're not vaccinating enough people, over time, the proportion of people who are susceptible to infection grows again, until you get to a situation where you've got enough fuel, and then the measles virus is introduced from somewhere, usually overseas, or the odd case, sporadic cases here and there, and then the epidemic fires again. And that was what my model showed. It was based on past histories of epidemics. The ministry knew how much vaccine had been rolled out, so we could assume from that how much had been administered. We had some data on the efficacy of the vaccine. So we had an idea of how much uptake there'd been. The outcome in 1997 was that an epidemic of measles actually started in New Zealand before they rolled out the mass vaccination campaign. But they'd already organised the mass vaccination campaign. So for me, it was, I suppose, the best of both worlds, because they could see that the epidemic was starting, just as my model had said it would start, but they were already in place to stop it as soon as it started.
Last week on the show, we had Professor Robert Wade talking about inequality. What's the impact of inequality in a society on the spread of a disease?
The impact of inequality is because diseases spread better, more quickly, when people are closer together. So if people are in cramped housing conditions, then they're more likely to come into contact with someone who's got an infectious disease. If they've got poorer nutrition, then they're more susceptible to an infectious disease anyway. And if the family is living in straitened circumstances, there appears to be a greater chance that the parents will overlook taking their children to the doctor for their immunisations, or either overlook it or just be too busy and too stressed to get round to it. So the ministry does target areas in which they know, lower socio-economic areas, to try and encourage people to keep up to date with their children's vaccination.
Is there a standard model of infectious disease spread?
There are a suite of standard models.
Right.
And models that are appropriate for viruses such as the measles virus are similar to ones that you would use for influenza, for example. But you've still got to remember that some infectious diseases are spread in different ways. Clearly, if you've got an infectious disease that's spread by sexual contact, then the mechanism could be quite different. You might have to model males and females separately for a heterosexually spreading disease. You might have to model different, what we call core groups in the population, who are at greater risk because of their behaviour. After all, with sexually spreading diseases, you'd obviously have sex workers who might be at greater risk. With something like HIV, you might have drug users who would be it injecting drug users, would be at greater risk from HIV. So although there's what would you might call a standard model, there are many variations on the standard model, and you have to make sure that you employ the variations that are appropriate. And one criticism you frequently get from biologists is, are the models too simplistic? But it's only too simplistic if you haven't adopted the appropriate modifications to the model. There are quite a few modifications to the model that might be seen as very important by some biologists, but actually make very little difference to how the infection is spreading. So you've got to keep in mind what you want to get out of the model. And when you know what you want to get out of the model, then you know what you should take into account and what might be a bit superfluous, and therefore it's not going to make any difference to the outcome of the model.
How do the models scale? Are they emergent properties? Are you dealing with systems thinking?
I'm not in the habit of dealing with huge systems. There are people who model infectious diseases by big, what they call agent-based models, where they have large computer systems with agents moving around and infecting one another. I suppose if you come back to what we were talking about earlier, I'm a mathematician, and therefore I'm interested in applying mathematics to how infectious diseases spread. And I'm less interested in the big computer-based simulations. I find that the large computer-based simulations are replacing something that's going on in the real world that we don't understand necessarily with something that's going on the computer that we don't understand necessarily. So I'm sceptical about how much progress we've made, whereas if I can do a mechanistic model of an infectious disease, and if that mechanistic model shows something that is similar to reality, whatever reality is, then I'm very happy, because I feel that I've achieved something. I've achieved an understanding of how that model is spreading through the population. And then once you've got an understanding, I feel it's a lot better to, you're in a better place to then move forward and think about how you might intervene and stop the spread of that infectious disease, if that's what you want to do, which usually it is, especially with humans.
So if there is an entirely new thing, like, I don't know how entirely new it was for people modelling it, but the swine flu a few years ago, where do you start?
Well, you start with a tried and tested model and see how it needs to be modified. In fact, I was involved in swine flu, but a few years before that, the Ministry of Health were concerned, in fact people were concerned all over the world, that terrorists might think of using smallpox as a weapon. And I was asked just to do a model of what would happen if smallpox were released into New Zealand. So I worked on that model and had a model of smallpox. And then the SARS epidemic started. And the ministry were then concerned about what would happen if SARS got to New Zealand. And I was able to take the smallpox model that I'd already done and just change a few parameters and apply that to a model for SARS operating in New Zealand. So you start with something that you know, and you then turn around and modify it. And I used a similar model for swine flu in 2009, when swine flu was did get into New Zealand. And I used a model based on the smallpox and SARS models I'd done earlier, but you change some parameters and you leave out some things and you put some extra things in. And I built up a system that could model swine flu and look forward to where the swine flu epidemic was going in New Zealand.
How do you communicate the answers? Is it a, this is what I think is going to happen, or do you have to some extent, explain the maths as well?
Usually I find if communicating with biologists, it's you try and put in words the logic behind the model. You explain logically how you think it's what you think is going to happen, and then you have an appendix which has all the gory details of the mathematics in it. And the biologist might look at that and say, oh, yes, that looks very impressive. And then a bit later you look at it yourself and you think, oops, there's a mistake there. But it's a mistake that made no difference to the outcome anyway, so you modify it and hope you get it right.
What about politicians?
Politicians take advice from their ministry, largely, which is good. I don't know how impressed with the technical side politicians are, but there are people in the Ministry of Health who have science degrees, and so they are really a go-between, I think, between the people in the universities doing the technical work and the politicians who want advice.
I'm thinking perhaps of things that don't affect us so much. I'm thinking of things like dengue fever and so on. They're being affected a big way. Well, are they being affected by things like climate change? That's mosquito is the vector,
yes.
Isn't it? Are we seeing effects there?
Apparently, some climate projections have some parts of New Zealand becoming suitable habitats for the Aedes mosquito that is the vector of dengue. And if that happens and the mosquitoes can establish populations in New Zealand, then all it would take would be for people coming into New Zealand with dengue from areas that do have dengue. And then we could have areas in the country where there will be a danger of catching dengue. I have worked on dengue fever in Indonesia and have published a model of that. And dengue is an interesting one. There are four different variants of the virus. And if you get infected for the first time, you get a flu-like illness, which, although influenza can be quite a nasty illness, after it's not a terrible illness compared to some. But if you get infected a second time with one of the other variants, there's an interaction that can give you what's normally known as dengue fever or dengue hemorrhagic fever, breakbone fever. And I know somebody who lives in Singapore who's had it, and I saw a photo of him in hospital with it, and he looked terrible, and he said it was terrible. So in Singapore they're very strict about leaving puddles of water lying around that mosquitoes could breed in, and they're really trying to attack it. But my colleague who was working at National University of Singapore still came down with dengue fever.
And have you modelled it in New Zealand?
Not in New Zealand, no. I did a project on it in conjunction with people in Indonesia, and that led to some interesting developments in mathematics, actually, in applied mathematics. But we were using results from pure mathematics, and we came up with a new way of looking at how vector-borne diseases could be modelled and how you could model the interventions that might reduce the spread of these diseases. So, and that could apply to other vector-borne diseases such as malaria, just different mosquito, or there are other viruses that are in northern parts of Australia, like Ross River virus, that also could be modelled using the same techniques.
Other than stopping climate change, which seems increasingly unlikely, what would the models suggest that we need to do in order to prevent an outbreak of mosquitoes carrying dengue in New Zealand?
I think it would be very difficult if dengue got here, because I was about to say that New Zealand's such a wet place, but then having spent a few months in Singapore and knowing that it rained every afternoon at 3 o'clock, well, that's a pretty wet place too. So, just keeping mosquitoes down is what you need to do. Because at the moment, there's no vaccine against dengue, although I believe there's been progress made towards a dengue vaccine. But then, with climate change, the mosquito would gradually establish probably in Northland and Hawke's Bay to start with. They're the areas that would be most at risk. So any outbreak of dengue in New Zealand would be quite localised. Just don't get bitten by mosquitoes.
We'll stay here. That would seem to be the answer. Let's go back and talk a bit more about the mathematics of planet Earth. That's not a UNESCO year, is it? It's recognised by a whole pile of different equivalent of the Royal Society all around the place. Do you know what the goal is?
Just to raise awareness, I believe, in the uses of mathematics and the potential for mathematics to contribute to all sorts of issues that affect the planet Earth. The waterways, our health, nutrition, well-being. There are meetings about the mathematics of planet Earth going on all over the world. I'm not sure, actually, who decided that this was going to be the year of mathematics of planet
but
Earth.
But it just is.
But it is, yes.
And do you think the goal is to engage the sort of the whole population? Is it a getting more people into maths goal, or is it a increasing mathematical literacy?
I would hope it would be both. We need more people studying mathematics, and we need more people understanding the contribution that mathematics can make to the problems that we face. Well, when I tell people what I do, they look a bit blank and say, well, how can mathematics be involved with infectious diseases? And then they say, is it statistics? And you say, no. And then they shuffle a bit, and if it's at a party, they will then say, I was never very good at maths at school, which is a very common response. And if I were a professor of English and I told someone at a party that's what I did, they would not say, I was never good at reading. So it's somehow become a badge of honour to be not good at mathematics. I don't know why that is, because people don't readily admit to being not good at other subjects. And it would be very good if we could turn that around and people didn't regard it as a badge of honour to be not good at mathematics.
I had a quick look at various sort of lists of things that we need to have people doing in terms of sustainable futures and citizen, active citizens and things, and it also is about critical, creative, caring and so on. I couldn't find it. I looked not for very long, but I looked quite hard for not very long. I couldn't find mathematics on any of those lists. So somehow it's not getting on to the this is the skill that's needed in terms of an uncertain future.
Oh, it is at school. Because
it is?
You still hear the government and the Minister of Education talking about we've got to improve literacy and mathematical literacy in schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a start after. We could do with five times the number of people studying mathematics at university. And I was talking to a student yesterday who's incredibly good at mathematics, and she had her mother with her, and they were saying, oh, but if you study mathematics at university, you know, what opportunities are there for you? And I had to point out that one of our recent PhD graduates, his PhD was in discrete groups and hyperbolic geometry, which is almost as pure as you can get. He's currently working for the Inland Revenue. So, because they know that people who've done a PhD in mathematics can think logically and clearly, and therefore can move into other areas. We've had PhD students who've gone to work for banks, in industry, for companies like Fonterra, as well as for Crown Research Institutes, or to go on to academic careers. So people can study mathematics to the highest level and then find jobs in other areas in society where the fact that they've studied mathematics is used to demonstrate that they can think logically and clearly and solve problems. So mathematics is all about solving problems, really.
So I'd like to think then that every mathematics graduate would be a sustainable practitioner. That's the thing that I'm pushing, because they're thinking logically and clearly and solving problems, and we've clearly got problems that need solving.
Yes. But I
suspect I'm being a little bit devious saying that because of that they would therefore be all working in the sustainable field.
Well, how do you define the sustainable field?
Get me started on that one. Everything. Every discipline, I would argue, needs to be contributing to a sustainable future.
I would agree. But you would still have mathematicians working in engineering, working in finance, and although increasingly parts of engineering and finance are contributing to a sustainable future, of course there are still parts of those industries that are not. And the more awareness you get, after all, mathematicians can make great contributions into doing things smartly. So, and that, of course, is a great contribution to a sustainable future, because the smarter you do things, the fewer resources you use to get the same effect. So I think that mathematicians have got a lot more to contribute.
This isn't your field, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I've got a mathematician in the room with them. Does maths offer us guidance on things like the tragedy of the commons?
I think it does. Again, there are mathematicians working in ecology, in farm systems. The application is every field.
Okay, I'll ask you, do you know the trolley problem, the ethical dilemma?
Okay, you better just...
Okay, I'll ask anyway, because what I want to know is, how does your mathematical brain process this?
Okay,
so the trolley problem, I can't remember who first described it, but the notion is there's a runaway train running down the track, and somebody has, don't ask why, there's three people tied onto that train track, and you're the only person that can do anything. You happen to be standing beside a switch point that can deviate that train onto another track, and the train will be saved. Unfortunately, there's one person on that track, tied to that track. What do you do?
So you said there are three people.
So there's three people on the first track, or there's another person on the alternative track.
So your question is, do you switch it
yep.
and kill one person instead of three?
Yeah.
which is a nasty problem to have for anybody.
It would be.
And the logical mathematical answer would be that you switched and saved two lives. That would not be a good outcome, of course, for the unfortunate person who was tied on the other track.
Mm-hmm.
And it is really a pathological problem that's been devised to try and say, well, where does the logic come into it?
Mm. And does it make a difference if if that person is a Nobel Prize winner in maths? No, there isn't a Nobel Prize in maths, is there?
There's no Nobel Prize in maths. There's a Fields Medal in mathematics.
Okay, so the Fields Medal winner in maths is that other person on the track. Does that make a difference?
Ooh, does it depend on what the other three people are? So, yeah, and the economists, well, these are not necessarily mathematicians. The mathematics can take the rules and come with an outcome. But epidemiologists have things called daily adjusted life years that they use to put a financial price on a life. And they use this a lot in health economics to look at what infectious diseases should be attacked. What are the priorities? And under that system, a child is more valuable than an elderly person, because if a child dies, they've lost a large number of years. And they could be disability adjusted as well, because if they have a large number of years in front of them with a chronic disability, then that could be viewed as less valuable than a large number of healthy years. So health economists are using those sorts of things all the time. And the mathematician really could take the rules as given by the health economist and then devise ways of saying, well, if you attack this particular infectious disease, then the benefit in terms of a dollar cost that's derived from the disability-adjusted life years could be greater than if you attack another particular infectious disease. So that's a bit like your trolley problem. You haven't got the drama of standing there with the switch and saying, oh, if I pull this switch, that poor person's going to get squashed. Happily, as mathematicians, we don't necessarily come face to face with the people who are going to get the infectious disease that I'm in the process of modelling. But you can give guidance as to where the priorities should be. And I suppose the priorities are like the switch on your railway track.
And my favourite definition of sustainability is that it's ethics extended in space and time.
Okay.
And so you could, sticking with the trolley problem, we can extend that in space and time by doing something like saying, okay, let's say instead of a person, it's a forest, and that forest has got the last two orangutan in it.
Yes.
Does that make a difference? Let's say that the train track has got a some sort of infinite, not quite infinite, but long loop on it somehow, that it's going to kill people in 10 years' time instead of immediately. Does that start to make a difference to your thought processes? Because in terms of the how we deal with future and sort of political decision-making, the best that we can do is the discount rate and so on. But the effect of that is that it has to be catastrophic in the future for it to actually make much difference by the time you discount it back.
Yes.
But intuitively, you'd say, no, actually, it doesn't make... Well, it might make a teensy bit of difference, but no, I still wouldn't make that choice.
The great thing about mathematics is you don't have to make a choice. You can provide a variety of different outcomes. You can say, if you follow these rules, then this is the outcome. And if you follow these rules, this is the outcome. And it's a bit like, as I said, there's the ministry between us and the politicians. You can present the logical outcomes from the different starting points and say, okay, if you apply this set of rules, this is a decision you have to make. If you apply this set of rules, that's a decision you have to make. Now you go away and make the decision. I can happily sit back and say, I've just given you the best advice of the logical outcomes from the different sets of rules.
A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Anne Pendleton Julian, who's an architect from the States. She was for a long time at MIT. Now she's various other places. And she's written a couple of books describing the work that she's been doing with her architectural studio with students. And the technique that she's using a lot is what she's referring to as, I think, ludic design. So playing games as part of the design process. So there's not playing a game in order to, you know, play a game to design this building, but you develop a game. And the reason you develop a game is to come up with what are the conditions that would result in the object or the model that you would want to have. And the reason I'm thinking about that is that it sounds to me as though you're describing the creation of games. They're not actual games, but it is about world creation, setting up rules and exploring them to see how they play out.
Well, there is a game there. A virus infects a person and it wants to reproduce within the person by infecting cells and then get passed on to other people. Now, the person has an immune system, and so the immune system has to come up with a strategy to counteract the virus. With something like HIV, the virus is changing within the individual person to try and outwit the immune system. And the immune system is responding until the virus gets the upper hand. With something like influenza, the virus is not mutating within the individual person, but it will go away and mutate in another host, probably birds, and then come back in a slightly different form, so that you might have seen one influenza virus and your immune system has learned to recognise that, so the next one that you see is slightly different and your immune system doesn't recognise it. So there is a game going on. There's a competition going on between the virus or the bacteria or whatever pathogen is involved and the host, being the immune system, or what, the immune system of the host being the response that we make to try and counteract what the virus is doing to us. So, yeah, you're quite right, where there are games going on. In the loosest terms of games, not necessarily children's games, but games of strategy with two sides. I'm not saying that I'm giving a purpose, a conscious purpose to the virus, but its ability to mutate means that the mutation that is more fit within the host is going to gain the upper hand.
Picking something else pretty much at random, it's just popped into my head, biodiversity. Biodiversity's plummeting a big time.
Yep.
In order to engage people in that issue, is there a way of thinking about it mathematically that would, I was going to say simplify, but that's not the word I was aiming for, but make it a tractable problem for people?
Well, you can... The obvious answer is yes. That's the easy way out. But just thinking, you can easily show, for example, that monocultures are going to be more prone to attack by pathogens, that the diversity there gives you more protection. So that is one possible way of looking at it. So, yeah, there are plenty of ways, just off the top of my head, where you can think that the biodiversity gives you that heterogeneity in a population that means that any pathogen that has to attack, instead of having only one target to attack, has a variety of targets to attack.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the role of maths as a communication tool for all of us. That would sort of match the... I'd like to think that maths could provide us with a tool for understanding the problems that we face. And that's why I was thinking of random things that are different to the things that you're focusing on.
Like climate change and biodiversity.
Yeah. But as somebody that is working in as a mathematics educator, a mathematics researcher, if we want to think that mathematics is going to help us, you know, solve bigger problems, I'm just wondering about where is the line perhaps of how much do we need to increase our mathematical literacy? Is maths a way of telling the story of these complex things that we're dealing with?
Obviously, I'm going to say yes again. But maths is also a language, and it's a language for presenting concepts in a logical fashion. And if in a talk you put a couple of equations up, and people are unfamiliar with the notation, with the symbols that are used, then they look at it, and it's totally foreign. And they go, oh, I can't understand that. So if we improve mathematical literacy, then even if the people with the improved literacy haven't got to the level where they can do it themselves, when they see the arguments put forward, they would have some familiarity with the language that's being used, with the symbols, with the notation that they're seeing. And therefore, it won't seem so strange to them. It won't seem so difficult. And so they'll be more likely to accept the arguments based on that logic.
The challenge is, of course, is that some pretty simple logic gets us to the fact that we are living on, however you count it, but between 3 and 7 Earths, and we've only really got one.
Okay.
Yet people, you know, there's some big numbers of how much we are over-consuming. And people just, like it's, they're blinkered to those really obvious numbers. So, yeah, I'm just going through my head about, is it that we somehow need to get people engaged in the simplicity of these numbers, that as soon as it gets maths, then it's not something that's somebody else's problem, there's clever people over there are doing it. This matters to us.
Yeah. Mm. There's, after all, a lot of the climate sceptic argument earlier was along the lines of, well, they can't tell us what the weather's going to do next week, so how can they tell us what the weather's going to be like in 10 years' time or 100 years' time? And that's losing sight of the difference between weather and climate, and the difference between the short-term fluctuations and the long-term trend. And just having an understanding of that sort of concept, which is a mathematical concept, could help. I don't know how much money exactly to the nearest cent is in my bank account now, and I can't say how much will be in my bank account next week. But I do know that if I spend more than the university pays me, it can't go on forever.
I was about to ask you, what are the challenges for you for the next couple of years? But maybe it's going and checking your bank account. What are the challenges for you for the next couple of years?
My challenges? To come up with better methods for describing how infectious diseases spread through populations. I'm very much engaged with that. I think it's a very important thing to do. And so I'm going to a big meeting in the UK in a couple of weeks' time to engage with people about that there. That's being held at Cambridge University.
All right.
And I'll be reviewing the work that I've been done. I'll have time to sit back and review what I've been doing for the last couple of decades, and to think about what I want to do for the next few years, and to talk with all the experts in the world working in this area. So
That sounds marvellous. I've been talking to Professor Mick Roberts, who's been in Dunedin as part of the Royal Society's 10x10 lecture series. His talk was on epidemics and pandemics, a numbers game. We did talk a bit about that and then managed to talk about a lot of other stuff. He was, I'm very pleased that he humoured me with my questions, which were kind of on his topic, but not really. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on Otago Access Radio. You can listen to us on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, or podcast on sustainablelens.org. You can find us for free on iTunes as well and on Facebook. We're brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High-quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.